Businesses have a responsibility throughout their entire value chains to respect human rights. If you can apply pressure at the top of the supply chain strategically, then you can achieve change at the bottom.
You are listening to Radio Atticus,
your national program on the law in the name of social justice.
This is obviously a live issue, and we need to start to talk about how we might regulate it here so that we aren't outsourcing our problems.
People are curious. They look at you and they want to know your story.
Radio Atticus, more than the vibe.
Hello and welcome to your national program on the law and justice and how it impacts your daily lives. Anna Marie Reyes.
Hi, I'm Sophia Carvajal. I'm joining Anna Marie on your favourite legal broadcast.
Human rights has been a hot topic recently, overseas and locally, where they're talking about the treatment of asylum seekers, refugees or minority groups. This episode, we focus on human rights issues from Iraq to Australia. Radio Atticus was there in Town Hall for the stepping down of Professor Gillian Triggs, outgoing president of the Australian Human Rights Commission. She gave her last speech in Sydney very recently. But first, we'll shine a spotlight on violations to human rights and in the ongoing conflict in the Middle East. Here's Vanessa Powell with more.
Just a warning that you might find strong content in the story.
The situation for civilians still trapped inside Mosul worsened in February when Iraqi forces backed by the US-led coalition made their push into West Mosul. Since then, all parties to the conflict have carried out serious violations in the laws of war. Bilkis Villay, Human Rights Watch's senior Iraq researcher who documents human rights violations, explains some of the historical context in Iraq. Since 2003, leading up to this most recent conflict, which left Iraq a divided country along sectarian lines.
Since 2003, in fact, we have been documenting abuses that have been perpetuated by what are mostly Shia armed forces. This is because after the government of Saddam Hussein, which was a Sunni government, fell in 2003, you saw the rise of a Shia government. And with that, you saw Shia forces take over the army. You saw Shia militias that, during the time of Saddam, had been in exile in Iran, coming back into Iraq and coming with them, bringing with them a lot of power to govern certain regions. And we saw this campaign of abuse that was meted out by these Shia fighters against the Sunni Arab population, sometimes in response to specific incidents, bombings of U.S. bases, Iraqi military bases, and sometimes more in terms of an act of revenge against this segment of the population that had been privileged under the previous government. And since 2003, as Human Rights Watch, what we've been saying, particularly to the Americans because of the level of agency they have in Iraq, if you allow these abuses to continue with impunity, which are really targeting one segment of the population, you're going to get a very nasty reaction. And as we view it, ISIS really is that reaction. And so it's incredibly frustrating that for so many years, the powers that be in Iraq, the powers that supported them, like the U.S., have been willing to allow this campaign of abuse to continue, and we find ourselves where we are today, where you have ISIS in Iraq and you have ISIS in Syria. At the moment, we have the battle against ISIS, and this is a battle to retake territory that fell to ISIS in 2014. And in the context of that battle, our job as Human Rights Watch has been, on the one hand, to document the horrific abuses that ISIS continues to carry out. And we've documented for over 2 years now the horrific abuses against the Yazidi population, rounding up of women, turning them into sex slaves, mass executions of Yazidi men, as well as any number of other abuses, particularly the ones you're seeing right now in this final battle. You're seeing ISIS start to use more and more chemical weapons against civilians under their control. You're starting to see what they've been doing historically but has gotten dramatically worse, which is the use of civilians as human shields.
Vanessa Powell interviewing Bill Casaville, senior Iraq researcher from Human Rights Watch, about the human rights violations in Mosul, Iraq.
Now, in Iraq at the moment, there's one big city that's still under ISIS control to a certain extent. That's the city of Mosul, second largest city in Iraq. And right now, we find ourselves in the final stages of that battle to retake the city of Mosul. And it's Iraqi forces on the ground that are leading this operation with the support of a U.S.-led coalition that has a very, very large role being played by the Australian government and the Australian military. And what we're seeing is that with ISIS, as they've been pushed out of territory and they've been pulled back into the center of the city of Mosul, and now they really only have about two neighborhoods under their control, they've pulled back civilians with them, thousands and thousands of civilians. So the main neighborhood still under ISIS control is the old city. And in the old city, which is 2 square kilometers, they have 118,000 civilians. So, I mean, that's incredibly dense. And it means that warfare is incredibly difficult. And that means that you're going to get a lot more civilian casualties every time that a rocket gets launched into the old city, every time that a bomb gets dropped on the old city. And what we've seen sort of as a recent change of tactics only in the last few weeks is that they're starting to actually weld people into basements. So they're packing in 200-300 civilians into a basement, putting metal doors, and then welding them shut and keeping people there for days, and then stationing 2 snipers on the top of the building, sort of inviting an airstrike. They're also carrying out really nasty sniper attacks on any civilians trying to flee. They've put metal planks out onto the main roads so that if civilians start to flee, it's easier to hear them, and then snipers open fire, often actually targeting the children on purpose to make it even more difficult for parents to decide if they want to flee or not. There's no clean water left in the old city. People are surviving since months now on rainwater, and as you can imagine, at the moment there isn't much rain in Mosul. They're surviving on a paste that they're making out of wheat and dirty water. That's the only thing that they're eating at the moment. And there's simply no medicine left, and medical capabilities in the area still under ISIS control. So that gives you a picture of what ISIS continues to do and what the civilians inside Mosul and still under ISIS control are living through. On the other side, you have the forces that are trying to fight against ISIS and retake the city. On the ground, as I said, it's Iraqi forces. And our role as Human Rights Watch before this operation began, and I think it's a rare example of where Human Rights Watch can actually play a preventative role in trying to stop the abuses before they happen, as opposed to simply reporting on them after they've taken place. We looked at the work we had done on all the previous operations in Iraq to retake cities from ISIS, and we looked at the units in and among the Iraqi forces that were the most abusive, the ones that have shown very clearly that they have no interest in prioritizing the protection of civilians. They have no interest in abiding by the laws of war. And in the most recent example of that, in the battle to retake the city of Fallujah, a city near Baghdad, and that was the major operation that took place before Mosul started, we saw specific units go into one neighborhood. They rounded up 1,200 men just because they were from the same tribe and so had the same name. They split them into 2 groups, took 600 of them, put them in a military base and held and tortured them before eventually local police actually found out that they were there and released the men. And the other 6 men are still disappeared to this day, and we can only presume that they've been executed.
Bill Casaville, senior Iraq researcher from Human Rights Watch, about the human rights violations in Mosul, Iraq.
And based on the research that we did, and it was very important that Human Rights Watch actually had documented that firsthand, had interviewed the men who had been held and tortured, interviewed the family members of those that have never reappeared, and interviewed investigators who have been looking into what has happened to these men. On the back of all of that, we were able to make a very public call to the Prime Minister saying, you need to announce that before Mosul starts, these specific units are not allowed to participate in the battle, and they are not allowed to enter the city. And because of the research advocacy we did, and because of political reasons with the Prime Minister realizing that the battle for Mosul needs to look cleaner than previous battles, he made this announcement, and he said these forces are not allowed to participate in the battle. The battle started in the east of the city. Mosul is split in half with the Tigris River down the middle. The operation started in the east of the city, and the forces that took the lead are forces that 10 years ago I would have said are pretty nasty guys, but for the last 10 years have had extensive training, including on the laws of war, mostly by the Americans. And as a result, today, they fight a pretty clean fight. And in East Mosul, I think I, humanitarian colleagues that were on the ground, were blown away by the level to which armed forces were prioritizing the protection of civilians. And if you talk about sort of a clean battle, this is the poster child. It was really something incredible to witness and something really exciting to see and to see that the commitments that the Prime Minister made to keep certain units out of the city, and he made another key commitment that we as Human Rights Watch had called for, which was to ban the use of heavy artillery inside the city because there were so many civilians that we knew would be caught up in the crossfire. That was very positive. That operation lasted from October until January. But unfortunately, in the context of that operation, the fighters that have this sort of more robust training, they were obliterated. They have a tiny number left, so few fighters that they were not able to play any significant role in the second part of the operation, which is to retake the west of the city. And as a result, the forces that have now stepped in and are fighting the fight in western Mosul are forces that do not have this level of training. They sit under the Ministry of Interior. The Minister of Interior himself is actually affiliated to the most abusive Shia militia in the country. And as a result, you see no real interest in prioritizing the protection of civilians in a side of the city that's even more densely populated.
With Iraqi and US-led coalition forces currently encircling West Mosul's old city, concern has been raised over the types of weapons being used in such a densely populated area where it's difficult to discriminate between civilians and combatants. The use of explosive weapons with wide area effects, such as 500-pound bombs, have been known to have been airdropped already. The launching of locally fabricated rockets by Iraqi forces and pictures of US and Iraqi forces firing mortars and unguided artillery into western Mosul can be unlawful as well if they are fired into populated areas indiscriminately.
And we're seeing use of heavy artillery by these armed forces inside the city. We're seeing them fire indiscriminate rockets into civilian populated neighborhoods. And at the same time, we're actually seeing a change not only in the tactics of these forces, but on the side of the coalition. So we're seeing American forces on the ground firing mortars from entirely inaccurate weapon systems into civilian populated neighborhoods. At the same time, you've got the aerial campaign. It's kicked up dramatically. And there, the work that we're doing to look at how this aerial campaign is affecting West Mosul is really done through satellite imagery. This is a key resource that we as Human Rights Watch are able to now utilize in our work, specifically in areas that are too dangerous for us to get to, or where we want sort of a bigger picture of the way the violations are playing out. And so through satellite imagery and analysis that we've done of the west of Mosul, you're seeing a level of destruction that we have not seen in any previous operation against ISIS in anywhere in Iraq. We're seeing more destruction than any operation in Syria, with the exception of Kobani. And what's really changed is not only the number of bombs that are being dropped, but the sizes of the craters. So we're talking 10-plus meters for your average crater, and that usually is a pretty clear indication that the size of the bombs has gotten bigger. So now we've got the coalition dropping 500-pound bombs, 1,000-pound bombs, where they were using much smaller munitions. And the rationale behind it from the military perspective is, you know, we have momentum, we just need to get this done, and we need to get this done as quickly as possible. The problem with that is that where we know ISIS is actually keeping civilians, like I said, 200 people welded in a basement, where we know that the density in this tiny area where the fight is happening is so high, what we should be seeing is actually the opposite. We should be seeing the coalition taking even more restraints, taking certain weapons entirely off the table, weapons that under the laws of war are entirely legitimate to be using in normal circumstances. But actually, in this context, in this small area, with this level of civilian density, these things should be taken off the table, unless we want to see a continued mass spike in civilian casualties, which is what we've seen over the last weeks.
Thank you.
was reporter Vanessa Powell interviewing Bill Casaville, senior Iraq researcher from Human Rights Watch, about the human rights violations in Mosul, Iraq.
So what's happening this week?
Have you ever seen laser beams in the sky?
What were you thinking?
I find an opportunity to lick Richard Wilkins.
Okay.
Interviews and discussions and all sorts of interesting things.
107.3 2SER.
UTS is number one again. Ranked as Australia's number one young university for the third year in a row because we harness the best of youth, the curiosity, contagious energy, and belief in a better world. Join us for a course info evening. For options, dates, and other details, go online and search for UTS Course Info Night. UTS, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.
I'm Michael Kirby, and you are listening to Radio Atticus. Radio Atticus is part of the Community Radio Network. I was formerly a Justice of the High Court of Australia with no time to listen to this, but now I sit glued to Radio Atticus.
You're listening to Radio Atticus, broadcast nationally through the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER. After 5 years as president of the Australian Human Rights Commission, Professor Gillian Triggs bade the audience farewell at the Inspiring Change in Human Rights talk in Sydney recently. She recounted the people she had met as part of her role, the dark side of Australian politics in the faces of refugees in offshore detention centres, and also talked of the hope for the future of human rights being in the hands of the people of Australia. Here's her speech in full to a packed audience in Sydney Town Hall.
Thank you, what a wonderful welcome, a wonderful evening. Thank you all so much for coming. Professor Phelps, lovely to have you here. And thank you for the generosity of the Mayor, Deputy Mayor, allowing us to use this remarkable town hall. I'm so pleased to see you all tonight. I've had to come through the security, some of you perhaps are still coming in, but thank you for joining us. It's a sign of our time. But I think it's important that we celebrate these four great Australians of the year, and to learn about their vision and hopes for human rights in the future. Thank you to the Australian Lit Council for the chance to speak to you all, for this is my last public speech before stepping down as President of the Australian Human Rights Commission. I can think of no better place in the Sydney Town Hall than to thank the Australian public for their spirited support for human rights and for the work of the Commission. Ultimately, respect for human rights depends on each of you, the people of Sydney and the whole Australian community. I leave the Commission in safe hands with my colleagues and staff, including the Commissioners for Sex, Race, Age, Children, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, Disabilities and General Human Rights, each of them advocating across the country for the rights and freedoms of all Australians. It has been my true privilege to serve in a national role for human rights, and I thought in the few minutes I have tonight, I might tell you just a little bit of some of the things that I've been doing. Because I've seen some of the best that Australia can offer in an aged care home for retired Aboriginal stockmen, 3 hours' drive out of Katherine on a long, dusty red road in the very centre of Australia. But I've also seen the dark side of our nation, visiting Christmas Island 3 times in the phosphate dust and the children crawling in it. I've been to the immigration detention centres in Villawood and Melbourne, Hobart, Adelaide, Darwin and Brisbane, and most recently in Yongah Hill in Western Australia. Places of despair tempered by hope for a better life. It is a great sadness to me that as I leave, more than 50 children and their families remain on Nauru, hoping for a future somewhere. The Commission's collaborated with business leaders who get human rights. And on one memorable day, I went on a walkabout in Bateman's Bay to visit some small businesses there. But I terrified the local shopkeepers who wanted to know why I was there and what they'd done wrong. I assured them that I was there to help. And indeed, one local business owner followed me down the road saying, please ask the Prime Minister to send us some Syrian refugees to reinvigorate the community. I did pass that message on.
You're listening to the final public address of Professor Gillian Triggs, outgoing President of the Australian Human Rights Commission.
My colleagues, I've worked with Muslim communities throughout the country. I've had afternoon tea with Tamil families of doctors and lawyers, teachers and nurses. I've attended the new Jewish Holocaust exhibition here in Sydney. I joined Mardi Gras for the first time this year, covered in sparkling blue paint, to support marriage equality, and I visited women's refuges. With the Commission, I've worked on human rights in China, Mongolia, Vietnam, Sri Lanka, and Laos, and with Indonesia on the death penalty, sadly, to the full effect. And I've had the privilege of working with the United Nations Human Rights Bodies to speak up about what we do so well in Australia and those things that we do not do well. But finally, of course, I've made some all too regular appearances before Senate estimates, committees and other parliamentary bodies. I won't miss those. So as you can see, it's been a roller coaster ride for me over the last 5 years, and I've learned a lot, especially that Australians do have a genuine commitment to a fair go. As our national anthem says, advance Australia fair. The ideas of social justice and the rule of law underpin our democracy and national values, and as a nation, we are prepared to stand up for them. When each year I watch the acceptance speeches by the Australians of the Year, I'm struck by the fact that each of them, in one way or another, speaks up for human rights and fairness. I admire them enormously because they act upon their values and they give their lives to achieving the values that I believe are so important to being social justice. So they inspire me, and I hope that they inspire you, I'm sure they will tonight. But of course, human rights are not for the faint-hearted. These are troubling, unstable, even violent times, where fearful of the unknown and justifiable seek security in the status quo. There will be opposition to the idea of equality and equity in employment, housing, education and healthcare. Few human rights are absolute, and each must be balanced with the other. Our liberties need to be balanced with national security in these times of random terrorist attacks. Though all responses that impinge upon our freedoms should be both reasonable and proportionate. I'm convinced that evidence-based policies can both protect our freedoms and protect the safety of our families. It's vital that each of us stands up and speaks out for our fundamental rights in what Professor Fox has accurately said is a successful multicultural society. We should resist laws that give ministers non-renewable discretion to overturn decisions of our tribunals or to cancel visas on character.
You're listening to the final public address of Professor Gillian Triggs, outgoing President of the Australian Human Rights Commission.
We must support the institutions of democracy, especially the courts and our judges, the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, civil society, and of course the informed media. We should reject indefinite detention without trial and the enactment of disproportionate counter-terrorism laws and secrecy laws that restrict freedom of movement and speech. We must stand against racism in all its forms and support freedom of religious expression. May I conclude by saying what a special honour it has been for me to work with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. I've learned to understand a little of the wisdom and deep spirituality that our Indigenous peoples bring to Australia. I hope that as the public debate about constitutional recognition of and consultation with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples continues over the coming months and even years, and that we're open to understanding the special place that they have in our nation and in our hearts. So may I thank each of you for your support, and for the lady that sent me the hand-knitted blue scarf, or the lady who sent me a lace frilled handkerchief. The flowers that arrived that made me think I must have died the week before. The wonderful support I've had, I know that throughout Australia we do believe in the fundamental values of human rights, and I'm so inspired by these wonderful four Australians. So thank you tonight and have a wonderful evening.
Because we're from Radio Atticus. What did you think of tonight?
Oh, truly Australian, open-hearted, and
for human rights from all over the world.
It's always very inspiring. I came last year, it was fantastic, and yeah, they're all quite very inspiring, especially Gillian Triggs, just fabulous. Fabulous woman.
What do you think about her? This is the last night that she...
Very sad. It's very sad. She's done such a great job.
What did you think of Gillian Triggs tonight? It's her last address.
I think she is an unbelievable superstar. I think she's probably the most resilient person I have ever met. She unapologetically speaks truth to power and hasn't stopped doing it no matter what anyone has thrown at her. And she looked like $1 million in that beautiful red coat.
This is radio, so I'm glad that you actually said that.
Yes. Yes, description is very helpful. She's just a class act through and through. She has a brain like a steel trap. She's full of compassion. And she manages to talk to everyone.
That was a final public address of Professor Gillian Triggs, outgoing president of the Australian Human Rights Commission, at the Inspiring Change in Human Rights Talk in Town Hall recently.
Sydney and the people who call it home. 2SER is seeking Sydney. Head over to 2SER.com and ask the questions you want our team to investigate. While you're there, why not vote for whichever question you'd like answered? 2SER 107.3. Stories, ideas, music.
So what's happening this week?
Have you ever seen laser beams in the sky?
What were you thinking?
I find an opportunity to lick Richard Wilkins.
Okay.
Interviews and discussions and all sorts of interesting things.
107.3 2SER.
You're listening to Radio Atticus, broadcast nationally to the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER. I'm Anne-Marie Reyes.
And Sophia Carvajal.
Well, I'm Gillian Triggs. And for legal news, facts and opinion, listen to Radio Atticus.
A shout out to all our listeners around the country, 2Bob FM in Taree, New South Wales, 7RPH in Hobart, Tasmania, 8CCC in Alice Springs, 4NSA at Noosa Heads in Queensland and more. Thank you for your ongoing support. Radio Atticus has been with you since 2009 and we continue to power on because of you. The content you hear on Radio Atticus is not legal advice. If you need legal advice, please contact your independent legal advisor.
And that's about all we have time for in this edition. We hope you enjoy the show.
Radio Atticus is broadcast nationally to the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER.
If you want more, why not tune into our podcasts on www.2ser.com/Radio Atticus.
Tune in again next week at the same time and place for your regular dose of justice and the law here on Radio Atticus. I'm Anne-Marie Reyes.
And I'm Sophia Carvajal.
Stories, ideas, music.